opening presenter today is Officer Drew Gavrilos with the La Crosse Police Department in Wisconsin. Officer Gavrilos has been in law enforcement for 12 years, serving the La Crosse Police Department as a patrol officer, school resource officer, investigator, and most recently in community services. He's a tactical operator and crisis negotiator with the department's emergency response team, an original member of the Alcohol Compliance and Education Team, known as ACE, and spent 2 years as a special agent for the United States Secret Service. Joining Officer Gavrilos is also Captain Robert Abraham. Welcome, officers. Officer Gavrilos, to you.
Oh, me, huh? Well, we're going to talk a little bit about community collaboration and how we addressed some of our binge drinking issues here in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Our story kind of starts back in 2004 after the tragic drowning death of another college student, which happened to be the seventh in 8 years. The police department began to reevaluate our response to alcohol-related incidents. City of La Crosse is a population of about 55,000. We're located in the west side of the state. Matter of fact, we're right on the Mississippi River bordering Minnesota. And western Wisconsin has been identified as one of the top two or three regions of the nation, actually, for alcohol abuse, binge drinking issues, and whatnot. So we definitely had our work cut out for us. With the drownings, because they were all so similar in terms of the victims were all young males between the ages of 18 and 24. They were all college-age students, and they all, the drownings, we believe, originated all within a pretty close proximity of the Mississippi River. Of course, after a couple, the community began to create urban legends like there was a serial killer. And whenever that happens, and you know, and we didn't have any real good explanation at that point, that rumor kind of grew. So there was definitely community concern, not only for this alleged serial killer, but just overall the health and well-being of our community in general. In 2004, after a very high-profile drowning, Chief Kondracki called a town hall meeting at a local high school. And on the panel, including the chief, were several other people, members of the La Crosse County Sheriff's Department, members of our Department of Criminal Investigation statewide. We had AODA counselors, a number of people, a pretty diverse panel. And the idea was to open it up to the public, to try and kind of figure out where the public was and how they felt about the problem and how it was being handled. The meeting, although initially started out being a little negative, turned very positive. And by the end of the meeting, what we ended up getting out of it was the community believe that, number one, we have an issue with alcohol and the overconsumption of alcohol, and number two, that in order to address that issue, we're really going to need to work together. That you can't expect the police department to address an alcohol problem. It was clear that the community needed to be involved. We understand that in law enforcement, we can write lots of tickets and we can create ordinances, but without the community's involvement and their willingness to be a part of it, it doesn't have any long-term effects. So we, as an agency, created a team known as the Alcohol Compliance and Education Team, or the ACE team, and we got together. The chief kind of created this team, and we used problem-solving methods. Actually, we used it's called SARA, which is stands for Scanning, Analysis, Response, and Assessment. And we put together this team, and we began to identify and implement solutions, things that we could do both short-term and long-term to address the issue. And a couple of the factors that we found are major contributing factors to the problem. First of all, La Crosse has the second highest bar density in the country. Matter of fact, I think many years ago we were number one in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most bars per capita on one city street. The other problem is that our bar district, our concentrated bar district, is less than 2 blocks from the Mississippi River. So demographically, we had some issues. We also, La Crosse, Wisconsin, nationwide is known as having very low prices, and we have a disproportionately large alcohol prone age demographic. I believe that well over 20, well, I know 20% of our population during the school year are enrolled college students, and that doesn't include the 18 to 24 year old age group that aren't enrolled. So, clearly, again, we had a lot of issues, a lot of factors that were contributing to the problem. So the East team worked together. We worked simultaneously with a task force that was appointed by the mayor, the alcohol task force, and together we kind of created, or we came up with four main action areas, four areas that needed to be addressed. The first one was excessive alcohol use, abuse, and binge drinking. The second was the ordinances that addressed safety and alcohol. The third was the infrastructure and safety of Riverside Park. Now, Riverside Park is the park that borders the river that's right in between the bar district. So to get to the river, you've got to go through Riverside Park. And then lastly was the community's readiness for cultural change. And cultural is going to be the key word there, because as we get into this and as we begin to proceed through the presentation, you're going to see that much of what we were dealing with wasn't just a recent phenomenon. It's an issue that's been here culturally and generationally. So if we can go ahead to the slideshow. The very first slide, we've kind of called this Beyond the Binge, because we identified our problem. You know, binge drinking defined as four or five drinks in a row, depending if you're male or female. We didn't really think that binge drinking adequately described our issue. So we began to call it aggressive drinking, or coined it aggressive drinking, because that's really where our issues were. So that's Beyond the Binge. The puzzle that you see is just kind of a representation of community collaboration, some of the things that we looked at, and some of the places that we went and asked for help to sort of address this issue. You can see that the four main pieces of the puzzle included legislation, personal responsibility, education and training, and peer intervention. Next slide, please. That is something that we just found out on the internet. That's kind of an indication of how we are viewed nationwide. It's got the Wisconsin state symbol. But there's a couple of additions to it. The two people that are standing by the symbol are each holding a very large mug of beer, and it says, "Out drinking your state since 1848. So that's just kind of a very quick visual of sort of what we're dealing with for the people that can see it. Otherwise, you can find it online. It's kind of humorous. Next slide, please. In Wisconsin, some of the other issues we're dealing with that make us a little unique as opposed to other states. Number one, we do not have a state alcohol board of control, so all alcohol enforcement has to be addressed through local law enforcement. Last time our beer tax was increased in the state was 1969. It's currently 0.6 cents a bottle, or 6.5 cents per gallon. There was every year there's talk in Madison about trying to get that raised and using that the increase in revenue to go towards treatment and education, and every year it gets shot down. Almost unanimously. One of the other issues that this is a big surprise to people outside of Wisconsin is that parents can actually legally provide their minor dependents alcohol in the state. So it kind of supersedes the 21-year-old drinking age as long as the parents or legal guardians are purchasing it. We have over 60 breweries statewide. I think at one time it was probably well over 100. Wisconsin is home to 7 of the top 8 U.S. cities for taverns per capita. And, of course, Wisconsin is known for our extreme consumption of brandy. I think only California drinks more than we do, and they've got 5 times the population. Next slide, please. Breaking it down even further into the culture of La Crosse and what we're dealing with here in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And I apologize, some of the font can come out on the it wasn't compatible, it looks like, but that actually it looked better when we looked at it. But basically, Wisconsin has the highest binge and heavy drinking rates in the United States. And La Crosse County, specifically identified, is one of the highest in the state of Wisconsin at 29.5%, which is higher than the Wisconsin average of 24.5% and more than twice the nationwide average of 14.4%. And we did, in Wisconsin or La Crosse County, see a significant increase between 98 and 2004 in the binge drinking. So it has been over this time period, or these surroundings in the last couple of years, we actually have seen an increase. Next slide, please. Again, looking into this a little bit deeper, we found that although the 18 to 24-year-old demographic, of course, is the highest in percentage-wise for binge drinking and definitely more at risk, we found that Wisconsin leads the nation in every age category, and kind of surprisingly, in the 45 to 54-year-old age category, Wisconsin actually doubles the nation. We are at 24%, with the rest of the nation at 12%. And what that led us to believe, it really kind of, it just kind of confirmed our suspicion that, you know, if you ask the 18 to 24-year-olds how old their parents are, most of them are going to say their parents are between 45 and 54. And all of a sudden, the light bulb goes on, and you say, well, that now you have a generational issue where people in this area, this part of the country, are born and raised, and the alcohol is such a, the accessibility and acceptance is so prevalent. So it's not just a college student issue, which a lot of our local residents felt it was. Next slide, please. A couple of things that we've done through the department to try and address the issue. One of the things that's kind of unique, the chief actually created a university liaison program. I guess you kind of compare this to a school resource officer, but I'm actually assigned as a university liaison and have been for the last 2.5 years. My role is just to meet and be a resource to we have three college campuses here in La Crosse, all within about 2 miles of each other. Viterbo, which is a private school, University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, which is one of 16 or 15 satellite schools of the University of Wisconsin, and then Western Technical College. And again, with those three campuses, we have about 20, somewhere around 20,000 college students at any given time in the city of La Crosse. The University Liaison Program initially, at least prior to 2005, was more of just a kind of a contact or figurehead. But since one of our most recent drawings in 2006, we really, the position really became very essential and a big part of the response. Next slide, please. Safe Ride U-Pass program, a program that was actually initiated by the university, by the Tri-Campus Group, and it was supported by the city, where our city MTU provides free rides to and from the campus area on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights, basically starting around 8 p.m. and runs through bar time, which here is 2:30 or sometimes after 3 when the downtown clears out. This program, although it was initially grant-funded, is now 100% funded by student fees, and it's been a very, very good program for us. I think over 400,000 people have utilized the service since 2000, the inception of the program. Next slide, please. One of the things I'm most proud of is the University Liaison was a program called Operation River Watch, which was started in 2006 after our 8th drowning of a college student. Many of the college students wanted to kind of take part in the response, and we began to discuss student safety, kind of a student safety patrol down by Riverside Park, and this turned into Operation River Watch. And what it is student volunteers on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights actually patrol Riverside Park for us between 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. And sometimes we have as many as 6 or 8 volunteers down there. And they're identified with just reflective vests, and they're given cell phones and flashlights. And their job primarily is to be a set of eyes for us. And if they encounter anybody in the park that appears to be impaired, they contact the police, and we're able to get down there and deal with it. Interestingly enough, Operation River Watch is now almost a year and a half old. And in an FBI behavioral sciences report on the La Crosse drownings, the river loss program is considered a major factor in the prevention of additional tragedies because they had over 42 encounters in their first year. Next slide, please. Another community kind of student-driven initiative was called the Safe La Crosse Coalition. It was a group of marketing students at UWL got together and created a marketing program or a marketing scheme. They created billboards and posters. And if you can't see it, it's a poster of a glass of beer and a cell phone sitting on the top of a bar, and it says, "You wouldn't leave your cell phone, why would you leave your friends?" And there was a follow-up study after that marketing tool had been out there for a while, and they did a random study of college students and found that nearly 43% of the students who saw that actually said that particular message impacted their drinking behavior. So very successful. And again, student-driven. Next slide, please. One of the biggest components of this whole program has been the Alcohol Compliance and Education Team at the AGE team that actually went operational back in January of 2005. Initially, the role was primarily enforcement, kind of focused enforcement on all alcohol-related incidents, including underage drinking and over-serving. And the program has really kind of morphed into really it's more education based now. The AGE team since 2005 has created curriculum for responsible beverage server training, which is actually in addition to a state required certified training. and that's been very well received throughout the city. And they've been very actively involved with a number of other ordinance development and educational programs that we've developed here in La Crosse that have been very positive for us. Next slide, please. One of the things the compliance team or the ACE team does regarding enforcement are covert compliance checks, which are done fairly commonly. But we found that since 05, there was a 64% success rate in compliance checks. And 2 years later, we increased that to up over almost 80% and actually received an award, a statewide award, for that improvement. Matter of fact, last night, our ACE team was out and they did 20 checks. They did 20 businesses, and 97% of those businesses passed. So we're continuing to increase that. We believe that the alcohol education, the beverage server training, has been very impactful. Next slide, please. Responsible beverage server training, we talked about this. We figure to date probably well over 1,000 bartenders have been trained. The class is taught by police officers. It's offered free of cost, free of charge. And it is in addition to a state-certified course. Go ahead, next slide. Sober server ordinance. La Crosse is one of the first communities in the state of Wisconsin to pass a sober server ordinance, which incidentally is not a state law, where this requires bartenders to be basically sober and they cannot drink while they're working. Next slide, please. The public intoxication ordinance, which is also really a groundbreaking ordinance for us. One of the first, and we are the largest community in Wisconsin to have an ordinance like this, and it's unique because the ordinance itself has been in effect now for a little over a year. Actually, the first offense is a written warning, and with that warning, the offenders are able to choose between taking a citation or attending a class. Then, again, the police department developed a curriculum. It's based on motivational interviewing techniques, and it's been extremely successful. We've had now probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 people attend the class. And our recidivism rate is down to about 1%. We're finding out that you're 48% more likely to reoffend if you don't take our class, and about 100% of the evaluations that are given at the end of the class have been positive. So this has been a very, very positive thing for us. Again, unique in that law enforcement cops are actually using motivational interviewing techniques to get a point across, and it's being very well received. Next slide, please. This is just some information regarding the first year of the public intoxication ordinance. How many warnings were issued? 156. In the first several months, 78 offenders complied with the conditions and took the class. Only one had reoffended. A number of the citations were issued were actually issued to a small percentage of offenders because we have a number of offenders that have gotten numerous citations. These are people, transients, some alcoholics that just aren't going to attend the class. And really, the public intoxication course doesn't take up a lot of our time. So, I believe that's all I've got, and I think I'm just about out of time, so I will close with that.
Well, thank you very much, Officer Gabarros. Great information about framing the issues that are being faced in your community, which reflect often other communities' issues that they have with college drinking in their environment. We greatly appreciate the sharing of information about the coupling of consistent enforcement efforts coupled with policy initiatives and public awareness building and partnerships and collaborations. Sounds like your team has been doing some great work in La Crosse. We'll definitely look forward to hearing more from you during the question and discussion portion of today's program. For those of you who may have joined our audio call late, our topic today is alcohol enforcement successes of busting the binge in college environments. For those of you with computer access, you may join the simultaneous web presentation at www.ilinc.com/on-demand, O-N-D-E-M-A-N-D. The conference ID number for the web presentation is 108-5272. Our second presenter today is Lieutenant Jimmy Zolke with the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission, otherwise known as the TABC, in Austin, Texas. Lieutenant Zolke has been with the TABC for over 21 years, has extensive experience in the field as an alcohol enforcement agent and trainer of officers, both new and existing field agents, and has taught at numerous police academies over the years. Welcome, Lieutenant Zolke.
Thank you very much, Holly. What I'm going to be talking about today, well, let me back up a little bit. Again, my name is Lieutenant Jimmy Zolke. I'm with the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission stationed here in Austin, Texas. I've been with TABC going on 21 years. Luckily, I've been able to stay here in Austin. And to give you a little background on what TABC does, we issue the license and permits for individuals who wish to sell, serve, deliver alcoholic beverages. Plus, we are our own state law enforcement agency, so we do have police powers. In doing that, we work very, very closely here in Austin with the Austin Police Department, as well as University of Texas police officers, other local law enforcement agencies, whether it be city, county, or state, other state agencies. So we have a very, very good working relationship with the other law enforcement in enforcing underage drinking laws and regulations. What I'm going to do today is talk about our PACE program, and what the PACE program is the Public Assembly Code Enforcement, which is PACE for short, P-A-C-E. This is a program that was started by the City of Austin a few years ago. Our main emphasis at that time were to reduce the numerous hazards and the city code violations associated with larger gatherings and parties. And as a result of all those parties, we have to or have an obligation to protect the safety of the individuals going to these locations, as well as the quality of life of the Austin residents. The City of Austin has formed this Public Assembly Code Enforcement. Again, the acronym is PACE, P-A-C-E. The team is to focus, or our main focus, is to go into these fraternity houses, go into these warehouse parties, other special events here in Austin. Here in Austin, we're known for having a lot of special events. So we have to make sure that minors are not getting in there, whether they're City of Austin residents, or the main emphasis, of course, is we have the University of Texas here. We have Southwest or Texas State down in San Marcos. We have the Austin Community College here. We have St. Ed's University. We have other universities here in Austin, plus in surrounding areas. So we have a lot of people who are under 21 going to these events. And these parties and large gatherings are conducted throughout the city, whether they're downtown Austin, in the suburbs. We always have continuing get-togethers of these minors. And one thing, our mission of all the PACE program is the safety of the participants. One thing that comes to mind as far as college is the hazing problems we have all over the United States. We just recently had a hazing death that occurred, and we're looking into that. There were some final resolutions made. It strengthened us as the PACE team to take further measures to prevent this from happening. Also, our mission is for the quality of life of those affected, whether these individuals are the ones attending the party, the ones that are organizing the party. We're there to make them safe for all participants of the party. Some of the issues that we address. At first, the PACE team's history was, our primary goal was to ensure the quality of the life and the safety of fraternity parties. That was the main emphasis when we first started. But once we saw the need to address the situation, such as the warehouse parties during numerous festivals here in Austin, the large gatherings of 50 or more people, and I'll emphasize that here in a second, and also other special events, like I've said here in Austin, the need for the PACE grew by leaps and bounds, and we were getting requests by other neighborhood associations around Austin, other police officers who were calling or contacting the PACE team to help them in problem areas. And other groups, as far as, like I said, neighborhood associations, sometimes schools, principals will contact us, hey, we know of this situation happening around the city of Austin. So it is, again, the PACE team has just grown by leaps and bounds with all that we have done in the past and things that we may do in the future. Some of the safety things that we looked at as far as the fraternities, of course, we have the underage drinking violations, the age-related violations. But some of the things, and I'll talk about that in a second, some of the other main focuses of the fraternities were, the fraternities were, during these big parties they would throw on the weekends, they would build or try to outbuild other fraternities in these temporary structures, which would be unsafe for the attendees, unsafe for the participants who are going to these parties. We've even had one or two occurrences where the attorneys would build these structures and they were collapsing on individuals there at the fraternity party itself. Another thing we will look at as far as the PACE team, again, we'll get to the age-related violations, but some of the things the PACE team has looked at or does look at every time we make an inspection are the zoning requirements of the city of Austin, making sure that they only allowed to do the construction during a certain period of time. And in reference to underage drinking, we've made an inspection one time with the PACE team. We walked into a fraternity house, and they had a full-size bar built inside their big ballroom of sorts. And the party was quashed as soon as we started investigating, why is that bar there? What do you have planned for this evening? Once we told them what we were looking at and what the PACE team's emphasis was, the party was stopped before it even started. So that's one other benefit of the PACE team. Another thing we looked at as far as being on the PACE team was the risk of the fire code hazards associated with large groups of individuals in confined areas. And I will give you a prime example. We had a fraternity during the winter months here in Texas where they shredded newspaper to make it look like snow on the floor of this fraternity. And lo and behold, someone either threw a cigarette or a candle or something, and the whole fraternity house went up in flames. Thank goodness no one was injured, no one died during this incident. But that's just another thing that we as a PACE team look before and tell these individuals, you can't do this. This violates this code. Again, the whole emphasis on the PACE team is the quality of life. Of course, as far as the enforcement of underage drinking laws, whenever a organization has or fixing to have an event, they will contact the PACE team. There is an application process that they must fill out. It tells us, you know, when, where, what the party is about, more or less. The PACE team, some of the PACE team members will go there prior to the event and more or less explain to the individuals who are in charge of putting together this event, you need to do this as far as fire codes. You need to make sure that, again, no minors are drinking underage. Is alcohol going to be there in the first place? Is food being served? There's a whole lot of a checklist that these individuals have to go through and look at to make sure, again, the quality of life of these parties or events are safe. Or am I saying that we condone these parties? Absolutely not. We are making sure they are safe for the participants. We are making sure that the organization, individuals, fraternities do as much as they can to prevent any bad thing from happening. Again, our main focus of the PACE team before was the fraternities. The neighborhood association around these fraternities and West Campus here in Austin for the University of Texas were just ecstatic of how much a difference made with the PACE team going to these fraternities prior to these events, during these events, and monitoring and making sure they're all in compliance. The neighborhood association was just, they could not say enough good things about the PACE team. Yes, the fraternities at first were very, very hesitant to, I wouldn't say comply with our needs as far as the PACE team, but through time, they saw the bigger picture. And now, very few of them really put up any kind of static. They know what to do. The application for the public assembly permit is online. We have made it so easy for them to comply, to make sure their event is a safe event. And again, I keep on harping on the quality of life, but that is the main focus of these fraternity parties. Let's go to the next step, which is the warehouse parties. Here in Austin, we have the 6th Street. Everybody knows, especially those from Texas, know about the 6th Street. It's just one big street full of bars. Even the side streets are full of bars. We have the warehouse district. Here in Austin, a place can sell for on-premise consumption of alcohol until 2 a.m. Well, sometimes these organizations, not really the licensed premises, but other organizations, will rent out these warehouses, not selling alcohol per se, but open up for after-hour parties. There were so many code violations as far as city codes. There were so many violations as far as underage drinking taking place, making available the minors consuming possession of alcohol, that renters or people who own those warehouses were contacting the pasting. Yeah, I had this individual or this organization coming, renting out or wanting to rent out these warehouses. What do I need to do to make sure nothing bad happens? They would contact the pasting, and in turn, the people who own the building would contact the organization. Hey, have you contacted the pasting to make sure you're in compliance? What kind of party is this, et cetera? So that has grown by leaps and bounds. As far as the main focus is on the PACE qualifiers to get a public assembly permit is also if any event, whether it be at a fraternity house, whether it be at a warehouse, whether it be at someone's residence, if you have 50 or more people at that event, you are required to get a public assembly permit for change of status by the City of Austin. Again, what does that entail? That entails an employee of a fire department to come by the location prior to the event to make sure all your exits are open. Do you have enough exits, electrical outlets, et cetera? There's a bunch of codes that they look at to make sure, again, the quality of life of this event, to make sure nothing bad happens. They do that prior to the event. The PACE team, which we are included, like I said, we'll go there the night of the event. We might go there once or twice, depending on what else we have to inspect that night. We'll go by there prior to the event that night to make sure everything is in compliance. We might come by there 3 or 4 hours later to see how the crowd is, see if they do have everything in order. So that's one thing that the PACE team really looks at, or helps these individuals as much as possible to make sure their event is safe and nothing bad will happen. As far as the age-related violations, anytime you have a get-together, whether it be at a fraternity house, whether it be at a warehouse, whether it be at a private residence, any kind of establishment, being in a college town like we are, the University of Texas has close to 50,000 students through time. We, of course, will look at the minors in possession. We will look at the offense, minors consuming. We will also look at, especially these fraternity parties, for making alcoholic beverages available. All we need is once we follow the PACE team into these events, the city employees do have the right to inspect anytime a public assembly permit is issued. We will follow the Austin police officers, a.k.a. the PACE team, for their safety to make sure they're all right inside. And plus, we will also observe for our violations as far as age-related violations. Some of these places, like I spoke to earlier about the one fraternity that was building a bar inside their fraternity house, I'm sure they were going to have donation jars or a charge at the door, a cover charge, or an entrance fee of any kind that sale of alcoholic beverages without a permit. The other offense is the possession of the alcohol with intent to sell. That's two violations we have in our code book. So a lot of things can happen or can have a domino effect once we make these inspections of the fraternities. Of a, and I harp on fraternities, which I don't mean to, but let's say, for example, an apartment. Someone has a big party in their apartment. We, as far as if they have 50 or more people, they have to get a permit. So the word has spread in the last year plus of what these college students can and cannot do, whether it be a fraternity, whether it be a house party. Word has spread like wildfire, especially in the University of Texas, of what they need to do to comply with the city codes, what they need to do to comply with TABC, our regulations, and other state regulatory avenues, per se. The other thing that we look at, of course, is make sure no one leaves the party DUI as far as the minors. That offense, if the minor has any detectable amount of alcohol, I didn't say measurable, I meant detectable. So if I smell alcohol, if I see them drinking a beer, that is a detectable. Again, I'm not meaning measurable. A lot of people think DUI, you got to blow in the breathalyzer. That is incorrect. This statute only has the phrase detectable amount of alcohol in that minor system, a person under 21.
course, in the next step, during these inspections, we make sure that individuals are not publicly intoxicated, whether it be, again, at a fraternity house, whether it be at a warehouse party, whether it be at a special event or any kind of large gathering where 50 or more people are attending. I keep on saying the PACE team. Who is involved in the PACE team? We have our team members are comprised of, the City of Austin Police Department, the City of Austin Fire Department, the City of Austin Code Enforcement, us, TABC, of course, are involved, the Austin Travis County Health and Human Services Department, the Texas Department of Public Safety, the City Solid Waste and Services Code Enforcement. So the whole team has a special certain codes that they look at or certain provisions that they look at when we make these inspections. So that's off is the, or the results. Is the PACE team working? Is it a good idea? Again, from a couple years back when just we thought of the PACE team, it has just grown by leaps and bounds. If I get a lot of calls during the day, I keep on hearing the PACE team from other states. They call me or other cities call me. Hey, can you email me what the PACE team does or what all is involved in the PACE team? A little result after a year, when the PACE team has been going for a year, the implementation of all of our enforcement, the overall police calls or service in the studied area, which was the University of Texas West Campus here in Austin, the number of calls, police calls, again, dropped 800. 800 police calls, minus 800 calls, were made or not made within a year's period of time. That frees up the officers to take care of other more important calls. And when I'm talking about calls for service, whether it be loud music, loud noise, people parking incorrectly on the street, possible minors drinking. Again, the number of calls in a year's period of time dropped down 800. That's a lot of free time for the officers, again, to do other things. So please understand that not all these calls were exclusively public safety related. However, if you can free up, again, police officers for a specific area, about 800 calls, the PACE team is definitely working. Public safety can be improved in other areas. And I'm just not talking the West Campus target area. I'm talking all over the city. Matter of fact, I went to our PACE meeting. We have a monthly meeting where all members meet. The day before yesterday, voices against the PACE team. Of course, you have, the fraternities, you have college students under 21 that might voice their opposition against what the PACE team does. Those individuals or those calls have decreased tremendously in the past few months here in Austin because, again, recently we had a hazing death which involved alcohol. The fraternities have stopped voicing their opinion or at least slowed down. Some of the lawyers around town that wanted to voice their opinion have slowed down and in support of the PACE team and what we do in relation to all the code enforcement, all the laws that we regulate or enforce. So again, the PACE team is a great thing that we got together and put together. It is growing by leaps and bounds. There are more city agencies wanting to get involved in the PACE team. Again, it's just been a positive thing for the City of Austin. It's been positive for us, TABC, working together with other law enforcement agencies to curb the ongoing problems of these age-related offenses, whether it be a minor consuming, whether it be all the way to the other end of the spectrum where we have a death of alcohol poisoning. Anything that we can do as far as TABC, the City of Austin, University of Texas, DPS, other city departments is a plus, in my opinion, who, again, stops the ongoing problem of underage drinking. This kind of really concludes my presentation as far as the PACE, but if there's anyone that wants information about PACE, feel free to contact me at any time.
Well, thank you, Lieutenant Zolke. Fantastic information shared about a unique way to utilize local ordinances and enforcement efforts to reduce the problems associated with underage and hazardous drinking. We'll definitely look forward to learning more from you about additional information during the Q&A portion of today's call. Our final presenter today is Chief Tom King of the State College Police Department in Pennsylvania. Chief King has over 27 years of enforcement experience and is a member of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association, current president of the Central Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association, co-chair for the CARE Partnership Communities That Care, a board member and advisor of several community organizations, and actively involved in the University Park Campus Community Partnership, which deals with issues related to dangerous drinking. Welcome, Chief King.
Thank you very much, Holly. And what I'd like to talk today about is some of the programs we have in place here in State College and mostly in partnership with the Penn State University. But first, to a little bit about our community and the demographics of the State College Pennsylvania community. We're a very rural community that's located in central Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania State University by far is our top employer in our county. We're center county because we're the centralmost portion of the entire state, to give you an idea geographically where we're located. We have a population of about 80,000, of which 42,000 are Penn State students. We have both housing on campus as well as off campus, and I provide the police services to the city, and then my colleague at Penn State University, Chief Shilo, provides the police services up on campus. About 25,000 to 30,000 students live off campus and the other 13 on. One very significant point in most college communities is that two-thirds of our population is between the ages of 15 and 24. When we look at our U.S. Census data, it's very significant. 67% is in that age range, which is your underage drinking and also your in most cases, your age range that's going to engage in more high-risk activities than when you get a little bit older. Next slide, please. A little bit about our departments and the crime issues. We have a very low crime rate in central Pennsylvania. Most common crimes are crimes associated with assaults and alcohol-related crimes, vandalism, many noise complaints, theft of property, and so on. We have determined through our classifying of incidents that two-thirds of all of our crime is alcohol-related. Certainly, by far, our biggest challenges in this community, because we are free of violent crime, not totally, but for the most part, it's low violent crime. We deal with dangerous drinking. People engage in, an earlier presenter talked about it being aggressive drinking, dangerous drinking, what have you. It's a significant problem in our community like it is in many. And in fact, in 1998, for the first time in the history of our community, for at least decades, we were faced with some serious riots, both in 1998, the year 2000, and 2001, and that was all as a result of dangerous drinking by the participants. Next slide. Our department in the city has 65 sworn officers, and we have 17 support staff. And then Penn State University Police, which is a fully sworn and armed police force, also has 47 officers. Point that out because we just do not have a lot of resources when it comes to a university of 42,000 students, a destination town for many people across Pennsylvania. Our resources are very limited, and our nearest large-size police departments are literally 100 or more miles away. So we have to certainly rely on each other and be able to contain things with the forces that we have. University police do have, legislatively, do have authority up to 500 yards beyond the boundaries of the campus, and we certainly make use of that because they do have the lawful authority to come off campus and deal with situations that they either observe or we call for assistance. So that's very helpful, and that was a legislative change made several years ago. And the other key point is that they do have about 125 student auxiliary officers who are uniformed officers that are equipped with the radio, have no official police authority with as far as arrest powers go, but they are excellent eyes and ears for the department. Next slide. We have been partnering with university police for many, many years, but I have to say that over the past 10 years has been the most significant growth in that partnership. We serve as interact with each other literally on a daily basis. and serve as each other's primary backup. Just about every special event that we police, we do it together. We pair officers up together. We don't just both take responsibility for calls, but we actually join our officers together in the same car and patrol together and work very closely. It's imperative if we're going to be able to keep the quality of life the way the citizens expect it in this community. Next slide. Let's talk about several of our programs and then spend most of my time on the final program as far as the source investigation project. Before I get to that, there are several other programs. Holly, I have just lost my PowerPoint slide. I have a handout, so I'll be going through with that. So if there's any reference to something on the screen, I won't be seeing it. First of all, the Downtown Safety Enhancement Program. As a result of a death that occurred in 2003, we needed more services down in our downtown neighborhood where the student bars are located. We had a person who died at the hands of a bar staff person during a minor crime, was held down as a result, died from asphyxiation. A couple months later, we had a stabbing in the downtown that resulted in a serious injury, and those were very unique situations for our community. We needed more eyes and ears in our downtown, but we didn't have the resources to hire more police officers. I'd mentioned earlier Penn State has 125 students who are student auxiliary officers. They, in the past, had been exclusively working on campus. What we did was we developed a three-way partnership between Penn State University, our police department, and our downtown business association. Penn State provided the student auxiliary officers because they already had them employed, they already had them trained and equipped, and had good policies for them. We were able to provide the supervision overnight to have them walk our downtowns, and our patrol supervisors would supervise them. And then the Downtown Business Association paid for their time while they spent they walked downtown. We used them on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights from about 10 o'clock at night until 4 in the morning, and they patrol the downtown bar areas in uniform and report any developing suspicious activity or any crimes in progress to our police officers and serve as good witnesses for us and basically call us on the radio and direct us into the person who's in the process of committing a crime or who has just fled the scene of a crime. And that program, now in its fourth year, has been very beneficial in preventing many serious incidents from developing. Next slide. We also have, with Penn State football being a big event in this community, we have to jointly police the football games. We've been doing that for some time, but more lately we've been pairing our officers together, a state college officer with a Penn State officer, and we do that on each home football game. One significant change made last year because in our tailgating area, which is a very large tailgating area for the 107,000 to 110,000 people who attend the games, the university, which we help enforce, has prohibited any consumption of alcohol during the game. You're allowed to tailgate with alcohol before the game, and you're allowed to tailgate after the game, but during the 3 hours of the game, there's no consumption of alcohol in the parking lots. A relatively minor step, but an important one, because we had many people would come to Penn State for the game, have no intention of going into the game, but would spend all day long, including the game, with the TV on out in the parking lots, drinking and getting drunk and then vandalizing people's cars and other disgusting activities that would occur when people would come back to their vehicles. There'd be a lot of problems. So that was instituted. Next slide. We also participate in the Youthful Offender Program. This is available for first time underage drinking violators. We, in lieu of the criminal citation, they attend a 5-week course. They go through the curriculum, which is an alcohol education and prevention program. And on the fifth of the 5-week course, it's taught by a police officer that reviews with them all of their civic expectations and responsibilities of the citizen in our community, the expectations of our neighbors and the residents living here, and why we do the things we do. And that turns out to be the highest rated in terms of evaluation the best rated night of the course because students come out there having a much better understanding of why we do the things we do and actually how that some of the things they're doing that they think are innocent are really having a major impact on the community. Next slide, please. In 2001, after several of the riots, we urged the university to begin to enforce their code of conduct, not just on campus, but off campus. It made no sense to us in the city that you would have a code that would be on one side of the street on the campus side, but you literally cross the street onto the town side because a road that separates the university and the city. They wouldn't be held accountable in the same way. We'd have people getting caught for underage or disorderly conduct or assault, and they would be treated one way if it was on campus, and they'd be treated a different way off campus. We now have a code of conduct that applies throughout the entire community, anywhere the crime occurs. And we make referrals. Every single criminal arrest we make, we send to the Judicial Affairs Office at Penn State University, in addition to the traditional criminal sanctions that the person has to face. That program's been going successfully since 2001. Next slide, please. We also have the University Park Campus Community Partnership. This is a town gown forum where we do address underage and dangerous drinking. It is funded and membership is by both the university and the community. And currently it's chaired by a university administrator and our mayor, Mayor Bill Welch, is the co-chair of it. We meet each month to evaluate ways in which we can address the issue of underage and dangerous drinking. Next slide. Excuse me, I'm fighting a cold. I should have told you that earlier, so I apologize to the listeners. I'll do my best to get through this a few more minutes. I'd like to end by talking about our source investigation project, a very significant project that we began in 2004. We've always felt that we've done a good job at enforcing the alcohol violations. We do a good job at doing bar checks. We're doing a good job at a cops and shops program. DUI enforcement, certainly very assertive at enforcing the underage drinking. The one area that was very little enforcement, mainly because it was so time-consuming and it was so difficult, was the provider of alcohol. The persons who are giving large quantities of alcohol to people who are underage, and those underagers are then going out and putting themselves in very high-risk situations. For the most part, the furnishers, the people providing alcohol, were getting a free ride just because it was too difficult and too time-consuming. We partnered with the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board, who asked us to develop a model program that could be used statewide in 2004, and they funded the program. And as a result, we began the project, which is really aimed at putting more emphasis on the person who is providing the alcohol to the minors. Next slide, please. We should be up since I lost my computer connection. If we could go to the slide that's titled Two Primary Strategies, if that's where we are. We felt there was two ways that we needed to tackle this when we implemented the program. One was we needed to have a significant educational and awareness program to let everybody know what we were about to do, because we were going to begin to really change in a significant way our emphasis on the furnisher. And so we went out and met with countless student groups, with community groups, staff at the university, and just anybody that was willing to listen to our message before we launched the program to inform them why we were about to do what we're doing and the purpose behind it. And we felt that the education awareness was going to be a very key component. In fact, it was. After we did a period of time of education awareness, we began to do enforcement. Next slide, please. Because of our public awareness, you can see in front of you, if you have a computer, some of the local news headlines that were covering our program. War on crime is war on alcohol abuse, etc. Police receive grant to curb underage drinking. Frats try to curb underage drinking. These were miscellaneous headlines that appeared in some of the local newspapers as a result of our emphasis of promoting this program. So after we did the awareness, we went to the enforcement strategies, and we decided to do two things. One was we were going to do follow any lead we had as it related to underage drinking. In the past, we couldn't spend much time on that. Now what we did was we had people on call that were available to, if we got anybody or any evidence that indicated that somebody was furnished alcohol, we would pursue that lead immediately. We would call a person in. We would conduct the investigation. We would run with it as far as we could, including the written statements from witnesses, including search warrants, even overnight if need be. And if we could develop enough information, we would do the investigation immediately, and then if necessary, the next business day, follow up on it. Because of the grant from the Liquor Control Board, we were able to fund this additional follow-up investigation. The other way we did these investigations was to do scheduled enforcement details. Because the semesters are 15 weeks long, we focused primarily on the spring and the fall semester. So we figured there was 15 weeks in the fall and 15 weeks in the spring that we really needed to concentrate our efforts. So we actually had enforcement details. We had SIP-trained officers who would sign up for overtime through the grant and actually work Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights to go around into our high concentration of liquor establishments and unlicensed establishments to begin to look for evidence of furnishing alcohol to minors. And the officers would patrol the streets and patrol the areas. Next slide, please. They would use the leads that they would get. Most often our information would come from people that we would be stopping for underage drinking. They'd be committing another violation, and they would be underage. And it's very surprising how successful we have been at being able to get the underage person to provide information as to where they were drinking, exactly what they were drinking, what the location was in the house, what type of alcohol was, enough information that we could corroborate their statements, and enough information that our district attorney would take the cases for prosecution and put and send them through the Court of Common Pleas here in Pennsylvania. So we're very successful at using the underage person to provide us information as well as getting search warrants. Finally, the way we concentrated our emphasis when we sent out the team of SIP investigators was we would, and we should be on the slide titled Directing SIP Enforcement Details. We would obviously use it based on intelligence. We also were collecting last drink data, and we were using a GIS map to pinpoint where our assaults, where our fights, where our loud noise complaints have been occurring for the past year. And through this GIS map and last drink data, we would direct those officers to the area in which there was the greatest concentration of those types of calls. And with that data, they would patrol and look for additional violations. So instead of them going out randomly, just patrolling wherever they thought they might be successful, we based it on intelligence, last drink data, and also our GIS mapping. Next slide talks about what last drink data is. And essentially what we did was we have begun on every underage, every public intoxication, and every DUI, drunk driving. We ask the person where they were consuming the alcohol. They do not have to tell us by law, but we do get a high percentage of people will tell us where they have been drinking. And when we say where, we ask them specifically an address or a bar. And we collected that. The next slide shows you an example of the first time we collected that data and the different places in which people were drinking. And in this particular example, which is a real example, it shows that of the 191 cases that we had obtained information on, 87 of them came from 6 bars out of our 40 bars. There was a high concentration in just 6 bars. That told us we needed to focus more on those 6 bars than other places. Next slide. Prosecution efforts. We've had several challenges with prosecution efforts. We were able to overcome that because the district attorney of the county assigned an assistant DA to handle all of our SIP prosecutions. He was able to help us get around the challenges by defense attorneys by researching the law, and we made a number of changes to our program because of the assistance of the district attorney. And finally, the results of this program in the first 4 years of it, the alcohol crimes, as far as the enforcement data, our underage drinking, you see furnishing went up by 91%, underage drinking went up, public intoxication went up, and drunk driving went up over the past 4 years. Next slide is the crime impact on the SIP program. What we have seen since the start of the program, while those enforcement efforts went up, We have seen rapes and sexual offenses go down 18%. We have seen physical assaults go down by 11%. Thefts are down by 4%. Vandalism didn't change, and our noise disturbances in our neighborhoods, in our target area, went down by 21%. So we believe that the Source Investigation Project has been very successful at really impacting those common crimes of assaults and vandalism and disorders and rapes. And so we certainly believe the program that the Liquor Control Board has funded is something that we want to institutionalize into our operation, hopefully for years to come. And Holly, I'll turn it back to you. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you so much, Chief. Great information, wonderful results that you're seeing. We'll look forward to hearing more from you during the audience question and discussion portion of today's call. To kick us off with the question portion of today's call, presenters, I'd like to pose this question to you. What specific tips do you have that you think are essential for effectively addressing underage and hazardous drinking in college town environments? Presenters, the floor is open.
Holly?
Yes.
This is Drew from La Crosse. I think we found that the most significant impact for us here in La Crosse was including all involved stakeholders. I know it's kind of a buzz term, but we didn't really get anywhere with enforcement. And, you know, law enforcement by nature is really limited to how much we can do by ourselves. So enlisting the especially for us, the college students, as well as the college administration, students was significant, you know, really getting the Tavern League involved, local business owners, the hospitals. That's probably where we had our greatest, once we were able to get them involved, we had our greatest successes.
Great. Thank you, Drew.
And from State College, Pennsylvania, I agree totally with Drew. I'm going to make the same comment and emphasize also, I think, the importance of a consistent message across the community, getting the stakeholders buy-in, and then having a consistent message in which we're not in conflict with each other, where we don't have some ridiculous drink specials being advertised by a community who's otherwise saying we don't like this type of activity in our town. So consistent messages and then emphasizing to parents the important role they play, even for collegiate college students. Parents still play a very key role, and I think they're stakeholders that can't actively participate in the community that they're, many of their children are attending school, but they can play a role from a distance.
Thank you, Chief.
I'll be unanimous. I agree with Drew and Tom, too. We as law enforcement can only do so much. Once the community gets involved, say, for example, the PACE team, the fraternities got on board, they knew what was expected of us as far as the PACE team. We knew what was expected of them. We have worked great together. It's just been a positive, total enforcement effort on both parts, the community and law enforcement.
Thank you, Lieutenant. James, do we have any questions in the queue?
Yes, we do. We do have one question, and it comes from Doug from Pennsylvania. Please proceed with your question.
Welcome, Doug. Doug,
your line is open.
James, why don't we move on to the next question?
Okay. Again, participants, if you do have a question, please press star then one on your phone.
And while we're waiting for the question queue, I do have a question to pose to Drew from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Drew, could you discuss with us some of the indicators that your community response is changing the drinking culture in La Crosse, some key indicators that you think stand out?
I think probably the working intimately with the college students, I think a couple of things. One of the big ones was the drowning in 2004 really kind of bolstered the whole serial killer theory amongst the college-age students. And then in 2006, we had the other high-profile drowning, Lucas Holman. And because of our efforts starting in 2004, the response after Luke's drowning, you didn't hear much about the serial killer theory as much as you heard the community finally coming to grips with, you know, this is actually a problem facing the entire community. I kind of likened La Crosse to an alcoholic. And prior to 2004, they were totally in denial. And then after 2004, when we really started getting out there and hit hard with the public education and awareness, it was almost like they took that first step to admitting that there was an issue and that everyone had to be involved. So that was one, really just the way the community reacted after that 2006 drowning. The college students, just the way that they've really stepped up and started taking personal responsibility and a lot of peer intervention has been significant. The other thing, too, is something as simple as a 10% decrease in OWI. One of the concerns with the public intoxication ordinance was that, you know, we're gonna displace the people walking drunk into cars because they're going to be like less likely to get caught. Well, in reality, in the first year of public intoxication ordinance, our OWI arrests were down 10%. That was not any we're very aggressive like the other agencies in drunk driving enforcement here in Wisconsin, but yet we saw a decrease. So overall, we're starting to see the community awareness being raised. We're starting to see the entire community finally admitting that this is not just a college problem, or there's not some psycho serial killer running around drowning kids. It's really alcohol, and it's a cultural and a generational issue. And I think we're starting to make very small steps towards changing the culture.
Thank you for your response. Lieutenant Zolke, before we ask for an additional question, could you please provide our audience listeners with the phone number for how, or contact information for how folks may reach PACE?
Okay, let me pull that up. Again, it's on our website. Let me go to our page here. It is, I had that right in front of me. Hold on. It is PACE, P-A-C-E, at C-I dot Austin dot TX dot US. I'm going to repeat that. It is PACE, P-A-C-E, at C-I dot Austin dot TX dot US.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Sure.
And Chief King, briefly, could you let our audience listeners know, other than the crime reduction impact you mentioned, what have been some other positive outcomes of the Source Investigations Project?
Well, I think certainly our officers and the community have a much better understanding of the laws. It was quite surprising to find out there were some people, including parents, who think that they can furnish alcohol to their own children. Unlike Wisconsin, that is a crime in Pennsylvania. So I think there was much more emphasis and a better understanding on the alcohol laws. We also saw internally, we had 20 officers who really expressed interest in this SIP investigative part-time role, and really about 12 of them kind of became the key go-to officers. And we saw a lot of kind of job enrichment, something they did their day-to-day, day in and day out job, but they've now found a new niche that gives them something in addition to what they do on a daily basis. And they were working closer with the DA's office. They were filing more misdemeanor offenses. They were doing more investigations. They were applying for search warrants. And so we saw greater job enrichment. And certainly I think the amount of public awareness and education we did early on and continue to do, we saw increased communications with the student body. That is, you know, with 42,000 students, it's hard to get a good opportunity to interact with all those students. But we certainly had many opportunities to interact with the students. And I think because we told them ahead of time what we were about to do, we've had great response from them. Some of them not real happy about some of the things that happened, but certainly it's opened up the lines of communication. So I think those have been benefits in addition to the decrease in some of the crimes we talked about.
Thank you, Chief. Well, folks, it looks like we're about out of time. So on behalf of OJJDP and the Underage Drinking Enforcement Training Center, I'd like to thank our guests for speaking today and our audience for taking time to join us. If you have additional questions related to this call, please call the center toll-free at 1-877-335-1287 or send an email to udetc@udetc.org. And we will be happy to provide answers or connect you to the resources that can help you. You can also contact our presenters using the contact information on the website. For those of you who are not connected to the web presentation, I'd like to ask our presenters to briefly provide their contact information at this time. Let's start with Officer Gavrilov.
Thanks, Ali. My number here, direct line here at work, is area code 608-789-7209. And my email address, which is probably the best way to contact me, is my last name, G-A-V-R-I-L-O-S-A, at cityoflacrosse.org. And lacrosse is L-A-C-R-O-S-S-E.
Great. Thank you. And Lieutenant Zolke.
Yes, my direct number is through our office is air code 512-451-0231. And again, the best way to contact me is my email address, which is j.zuehlke@tabc.state.tx.us.
Thank you. And finally, Chief King.
Yes, my office number is area code 814-234-7161. And my email address is tking@statecollegepa.us. That's tking@statecollegepa.us.
Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, this audio call has been recorded. So for those of you who would like to obtain a copy of the audio call, you may send a blank 90-minute cassette or CD.